This is a CBC podcast. CBC Books is the home for Canadian book lovers. Enter contests, watch videos, and listen to CBC Radio 1's Writers and Company and The Next Chapter all in one place. CBC Books, where readers click. Go to cbc.ca/books.
From the River Run Centre in Guelph, Ontario, it's the Vinyl Cafe with Stuart MacLean.
Thank you very much. Well, for an unpretentious sort of place, for a town that makes no grandiose claims about anything, other perhaps than its own modesty, I have to say that Guelph, Ontario, where we are today, 90 kilometers to the west of Toronto, on the banks of the River Speed, a misnomer if I've ever heard one, I have to say that Guelph, Ontario, has much it could boast about. It was here, for example, in the 1920s, according to local lore, that the wire coat hanger was invented. Although why anyone needed to invent the coat hanger is a mystery to me. The things breed in my closet like rabbits. Canada's number one participant sport, five-pin bowling. That's right, my American friends, we have a mere five, not 10 pins to knock over. And we get three balls a frame instead of two. Eat your hearts out. Five-pin bowling was invented by Guelph son Tim Ryan. But most importantly, and may I be the first to say it, thank goodness, where would we be without it? The tin cup jock was invented here. At the Guelph Elastic Hosiery Company, known now as Protection Industries. They held a contest to name the product, and Jockstrap was the winning entry, a nod, no doubt, to the Scottish heritage of this modest and safety-conscious place. But of all things I've learned about Guelph, the bowling, the coat hanger, the tin cup, the fact that pleases me the most is this. There are no underground parking lots downtown, or none that I've seen, none of any consequence. And it's not because Guelph is too small for such things. It is a city, after all, not a town. And there is a downtown core of some beauty and an impressive university. There are no underground parking lots downtown because the city sits on solid bedrock, a foundation that is, above all else that it might be, the source of the most pleasing thing about this pleasing place. Guelph is a limestone city. There are more stone houses here, and by stone I mean stone, not brick. There are more stone houses here than anywhere else in North America, save for Kingston, Ontario. The limestone houses and buildings that grace this city and imbue it with its amber hue were built more or less 150 years ago, sometimes rising right out of the ground that they were quarried from. Sadly, in the 1960s and 70s, when all of North America was caught in a headlong lunge into the future, when we seemed to make ourselves the happiest by tearing down our yesterdays and throwing up, well, not much in its place, nothing with an amber hue, that's for sure. Back then, when we were doing that, Guelph didn't completely escape the wrecker's ball. St. George's Square at the center of town was once home to a post office, a customs house, and various banks, all of them limestone, and all of them now gone. But much remains. Like most great good things, it's been as much a happy accident as anything. Beginning with Guelph's good fortune of being built on the bed of an ancient warm sea. The limestone you see all over town was formed on the seabed. Stonemasons love it because it comes out of the ground, soft and easy to carve. There are carvings in buildings all around town, weather and wind rubbed like old gravestones, but still visible and decipherable to those who know them, and still a delight to the spirit. Venture a few townships over, and everything's made of brick. But there was no clay here to make brick. And before the railway came, no way to get brick here. By the time the railway did arrive, and they could have exported all the good rock, much of the good stuff, the big chunks from the surface layer, had already been used for homes and offices and commercial buildings. And, of course, for the glory of God. There are 11 stone churches in Guelph. Well, 10 churches and one mosque. Such is the march of time. The most magnificent, of course, is the Church of Our Lady, sitting on top of Norfolk Street, where God has revealed herself in her mysterious ways to everyone who has grown up here. For it is on Catholic Hill where so many of Guelph's citizens have shared their first kiss, first beer, first smoke, if not their first communion. It is the limestone buildings that caught my eye this week. You might well ask why I should care. Well, I happen to believe I should care a lot. I know the comfort that can radiate from stone. I have laid on rock that has absorbed the sun's warmth on a summer's day. Well, the stone walls of Guelph have been absorbing the sun for generations. But not only the sun, they have absorbed all that has passed, all the human history. The oil from the hands that have brushed against them, from the men who quarried the rock and cut it or carved it or built with it, and from the men and women who lived around and in it. The stone buildings I have admired here are as much storytellers as I am, and the stories they tell are the stories of continuity and connection. Connection to the past, and by way of the past, to the future. If you want to know about the future, the answers are always hidden in the past. For as T.S. Eliot said, time present and time past are both present in time future. And therefore, time future contained in time past. So here's to the quarrymen. And here's to the ancient warm sea that we all crawled out of. And here's to the secrets of stone. And here's this one last thing. When Guelph was founded on St. George's Day, April 23rd in 1827, they marked the moment with a ceremonial felling of a large maple tree. An act one can only suppose symbolic of all the trees they hoped would come down in the name of progress. Today, of course, if we were to mark the same moment, we would mark it with the planting of a maple. Such has been the success of progress. The trees are gone, but the buildings endure, or they do here in Guelph. And that is worth noting, and I'm delighted to be here today to do that. And to do it as we always do it on this show, with story and in song. And I'm delighted now to welcome today's special musical guest. She was born where my mom and dad were born, in Australia. And like my mom and dad, she made the wise choice to move to Canada. She moved to Winnipeg when she was 8 months old. She's a founding member of the Juno Award-winning band, the Waylon Jennies. But we invited her here today to sing from her first and very wonderful solo album, an album that's been nominated for a Juno, Western Canadian Music Award, and three Canadian Folk Music Awards, so it's not just me who thinks this record is special. Ladies and gentlemen, it's my great pleasure to introduce the terrific Ruth Moody.
Thank you so much.
Baby, it's cold outside. Come in, stay dark and the winds are wild, and I want you. I want you. So come inside. Come inside. Baby, what do you say? Can't think of a better way to spend the night. Let's do it right. Your smile is bright as a moon tonight. I can't see you in my mind's eye, and I want you. I want you. Thank you very much.
Ruth Moody. Ruth Moody, and it's from her album, The Garden. Time now for the Vinyl Cafe Story Exchange. Well, you know how this works. This is the part of the show where you send us your stories. They have to be true stories, and they have to be short. But after that, they don't have to be anything at all. After that, it's up to you. We promise we'll read everything you send us, and we promise to read some of our favorites here on the radio. If we choose to read your story on the radio, we promise we'll send you a copy of our latest Vinyl Cafe book. It's called The Vinyl Cafe Notebooks. We have a story today from Rod Wotherspoon of Ladysmith, British Columbia. Dear Stuart, writes Rod, last Saturday, my wife and I made a trip up island to say goodbye to an old friend who finally lost her battle to cancer. She had lived in Ladysmith for many years, but her family's roots were up in Union Bay. We chose to leave the parkway a few miles before town and finish the journey along the old island highway that hugs the water's edge. There were new homes here and there, but mostly we were driving by homes from another time, yards cluttered with pickups or tarp-covered boats waiting for spring. The kind of places where clotheslines and wood stoves still earn their keep. The town hall was easy to find. The parking lot was jammed, and folks were standing around in clusters, everybody dressed a little better than usual for a Saturday. Inside, the warm varnished walls were adorned with the records of local history, plaques, pictures, and other bits and pieces. The strains of Tell Me the Old, Old Story came from an upright piano in the corner of the room. The scent of fresh coffee hung in the air as several women set food on side tables. Egg salad, tuna and ham sandwiches, squares, cakes and cookies, coffee, tea, and juice for the children. And then it was time for the service to begin. A hush fell over the room, stragglers scurried for their seats, and the minister settled into the story of my friend's life, an interesting biography to some, to others, memories both beautiful and painful. A trio of women stood and sang. None of them had what you'd call singing voices. There was no attempt at harmony. They were just three cousins who wanted to present a tribute from the heart to a beloved friend. There was a rare honesty about that gathering. An old town hall provided an atmosphere that neither a church nor a funeral chapel could have offered. It sits there year after year, bearing silent witness to how people really live. It's seen a lifetime of town meetings, concerts, dances, wedding receptions, and yes, funeral services. We live in a world hypnotized with forward motion. That old town hall has chosen to let the world rush right on by. That came to us from Rod Wotherspoon of Ladysmith, British Columbia. This is Ruth Moody.
Broken windows and empty hallways, pale dead moon in a sky streaked with gray. Human kindness is overflowing, and I think it's going to rain today. Smiles to keep love away. before me. The signs implore me to help the needy and show them the way. Human kindness is overflowing, and I think it's going to rain today.
Ruth Moody. John Sheard's going to play the piano for you now. John Sheard. The album Firmament, that was John Sheard with Loch Lomond. Dave's daughter, Stephanie, spent the last 3 weeks hovering around her laptop, her heart fluttering, waiting for news. came finally on a recent Monday morning, and when it did, it didn't come on her computer. Came the way everything comes these days, a text message. 4 short words from her friend Scott. O'Neill's grades are posted. Steph stared at the text and sighed. Shouldn't have been a big deal. She knew all her other marks, A's and B's, all of them. And she had never, not once, failed a course. So how bad could it be? Statistics. That's how bad it could be. What had she been thinking? Well, she knew what she'd been thinking. She'd been thinking if she wanted to do some sort of post-grad thing, a stats course would look good on her transcript. What didn't make sense was that she had opted for the advanced class, the section designed for engineers and science grads. What sort of misdirected ambition had led her there? She glanced at her phone. Her little spasm of grad school hubris had probably ruined her chances for grad school admission. She had failed statistics. She's pretty certain of that. She stood up and walked across the kitchen, picked up the kettle and carried it to the sink. She should have dropped the course, of course. Should have dropped it after the first class. The warning signs had been there as plain as day. 12 students in a lecture hall that seated 300. She told herself the class was empty because the material was famously complicated. Told herself that she was up to the challenge. She convinced herself that the challenge would be good for her. She filled the kettle and carried it back to the stove. She opened the cupboard beside the sink and removed a blue and yellow cardboard box the size of a pound of butter. Herbal tea. Harmony, comfort, tension tamer. She slammed it down on the counter. In the initial blush of enthusiasm, she had found the class challenging and fun. Dispersions and tendencies, regressions and box plots. Unlike everything else she studied, there were rules. All you had to do was apply the rules. I like statistics, she told her boyfriend, Tommy. And then a week later, maybe two, this is impossible, she said. I hate statistics. But before we talk about the course, I probably should mention Professor O'Neill. Turned out Professor O'Neill was loony, said Stephanie, certifiably bonkers. Actually, we should talk about the cat. A ridiculously overweight tabby that Professor O'Neill lugged around under his arm, everywhere, like a textbook. He wandered into class and dropped the cat on an empty desk near the front, and it sat there twitching its tail like a metronome. Every day he dropped the cat on the desk and then began erasing the blackboard. Well, they all do that, said Tommy. It's like a warm-up exercise. Think of it as academic calisthenics. Sure, except there was no blackboard to erase. Professor O'Neill used the blackboard that hovered just behind his lectern, unseen by anyone else. An imaginary blackboard, said Tommy, perking up. Yes, said Stephanie, waving her hand in the air as if she was hailing a cab. And after he cleans it, he writes on it. With imaginary chalk, said Tommy, hopefully. Tommy was leaning forward. He was listening intensely. He had never shown this much interest in any of her courses. Sometimes, said Stephanie, after he writes something, he erases it and starts again. When he makes an imaginary mistake, said Tommy, earnestly. It was all so incredibly weird. The empty lecture hall, the cat, the imaginary blackboard, and, of course, the timetable. Monday mornings at 8, Fridays at 4. How did you get a schedule like that? You pick a fight with the registrar, said Tommy. Bingo, said Stephanie. Professor O'Neill and the university registrar had, famously, been waging a feud that began in the 1970s. It began, according to legend, the September Professor O'Neill was accidentally mailed a sticker assigning him the registrar's primo parking spot. Security was dispatched to Professor O'Neill's office to explain the error and that he shouldn't actually park in the registrar's spot. But Professor O'Neill continued to pull into the space every morning. He ignored the tickets and the notices that began accumulating on his windshield. In fact, he left them there, driving around campus with the flurry of indictments flapping in the wind. According to the story, the apoplectic registrar eventually took matters into his own hands. He arrived at school before dawn one morning and pulled into the space before Professor O'Neill. When he arrived and saw what had happened, Professor O'Neill parked in a visitor spot, waited until the registrar left for the day, slid his car into the disputed spot, and took the bus home. He left his car there and got to and from work by public transportation for 7.5 months. Until the Dean of Science retired, and a sign with the registrar's name went up in the dean's old spot. The registrar had conceded, but he hadn't forgotten. And that's why he scheduled O'Neill's statistics course for the worst possible times, and why the agoraphobic O'Neill was assigned cavernous lecture halls for his handful of students. Professor O'Neill's classes were torture. After a month, Stephanie came to her senses and tried to switch out, but by then, the other stats course was full, and she was hooped. "I understand you were trying to get out of my class," said Professor O'Neill. He caught her off guard. "I'm allergic to cats," said Stephanie. She was petting the cat as she said it. It was the best she could do on the spur of the moment. As the weeks marched on, it became clear that statistics was an ordeal for everyone. One day, Scott fell asleep, and he dropped his pen. He was sitting on the aisle, so the pen clattered down the stairs toward the lectern, step after echoey step. Professor O'Neill stopped talking and glared at the pen as it rolled toward him like a wind-up toy. When it finally stopped at his feet, he glared up at Scott. And at that exact moment, with everyone staring at him now, Scott's head snapped backwards, and he began snoring loudly. Somehow, Stephanie passed the midterm. Barely, but she passed. So as the second term began, she allowed herself to feel hope. Maybe she would get through statistics after all. Then came April. And the oppression of final exams settled over Stephanie and indeed the entire campus, like the Black Death. This wasn't Stephanie's first April at university. She knew the drill. She started rationing her money in February and her food. So when classes ended, she had money and food, not a lot of either, but more than most. Cheerios and peanut butter, tuna fish and crackers. Unlike the April before, when she had survived on Mr. Noodles and the occasional foray to Costco, where she pushed an empty cart up and down the aisles, assembling meals from the free samples. And now it was April again. And though she wasn't broke, it felt like it. You could feel desperation everywhere. Student loans, summer cash, cafeteria cards, all used up, all spent. Couldn't help but dampen your mood. And her steady diet of cold tuna and milk wasn't making her feel any better. It was through all this that she had to prepare for Professor O'Neill's final. Everyone said that 30% of those who took the course failed. He bell curves for failure. Whatever he did, Stephanie needed to be sure that she wouldn't have to take it again. To make things worse, the statistics exam was, of course, scheduled by the registrar for the very last day. The weather turned warm, and everyone else was slowly finishing up. Stephanie kept getting texts, "Come to the beach, come to the bar, come play tennis." With 7 days to go, she mapped out a plan that had her studying 10 hours a day. After a few days, she had fallen a day and a half behind. The Saturday before the exam, she decided to pull an all-nighter and see if she could catch up. "I'll do your laundry," said Becky. "I'll bring supper," said Janice. Janice brought 2 Red Bulls with supper. "I don't know," said Stephanie. She drank the first one at 10 p.m. "I don't feel anything," she said. Janice handed her the other. Tommy came over at 2 in the morning. Stephanie had moved all the furniture to the center of the room. She was down on her hands and knees, scrubbing the baseboards with a toothbrush. On Monday, with 4 days before the exam, she felt like she was going stir crazy. She had to get out of her place, so she went to the library. There was 1 empty chair at a table with 6 other people. She sat down. The girl opposite her was chewing her hair. The boy to her right was biting his nails. The guy at the far end, the guy with a blue hoodie, was highlighting every single line in his textbook. Every single one. How could anyone concentrate with that going on? She lasted less than an hour. She wandered around the campus. There had to be a quiet spot somewhere. She tried the caf, but it was full too. She went to the fitness center and sat in the gym in the top row of the bleachers. That worked for an hour, until 3 boys came in and started shooting baskets, and she gave up. On her way home, she wandered into the science building. She'd never been there before. She took the elevator up to the top floor and walked down a long corridor past a bunch of faculty offices and into a big room. Some sort of research greenhouse. She found a desk by a bunch of weird plants and sat down. She stayed at that little desk until after 10 and went back to it over the next 3 days. No one ever asked her who she was or what she was doing there. She had never studied for anything as hard as she was studying for this. As the days passed, she began to feel she might pass. She began to feel hopeful. On Thursday night, the night before the exam, she vowed she wouldn't drink anything to stay awake. She wanted to make sure she got a good night's sleep. When Tommy came over around midnight, she was still up. She was sitting at the kitchen table in her pajamas, her skin pale, her eyes dark. She had papers and textbooks spread all around her. There was also a jar of instant coffee and a spoon. There were little flecks of coffee dust on her lips. "I'm almost finished," she said. "I can see that," said Tommy, looking at the almost empty jar. He leaned over and gave her a kiss on the top of her head. She went to bed at 4:20. When her alarm went off 4 hours later, she sat bolt up in bed, her heart pounding. This was it. Professor O'Neill proctored the exam himself, and he brought his cat, of course. Stephanie sat down at the folding table in the cavernous exam room. She stared at the exam when the student helper placed it on her desk upside down. 8 pages, stapled. When Professor O'Neill said, You can begin. She took a deep breath and turned it over. The first thing she felt was a flush of panic. The numbers looked like a maze on the page. The formulas seemed only vaguely familiar, like half-forgotten nursery rhymes from long ago. Her heart started to pound. She made herself read the whole thing from start to finish. She wrote her name and student number on the top of the exam booklet, and then she began on question one. She has no idea how long she was out, but Professor O'Neill was standing beside her desk, glaring down at her when she woke up. She sat up quickly. "I was just thinking," she said. They both looked down at her exam book at the same time, at the big, wet drool mark. Professor O'Neill didn't say anything. He shook his head and walked away. She still had time to finish the exam, but she finished with a sense of gloom. Everyone else had left when she finally stood up and walked to the front and handed her book in. And when she did, Professor O'Neill's cat hissed at her. It felt like an omen. And here she was, all these weeks later, sitting in her kitchen, staring at her computer. She took a sip of her tea, shrugged, and typed in her password. She sat perfectly motionless, staring at the little wheel as it spun around and around. All those days and all those nights, all the work, all the angst, had all come down to this. Her student page snapped up. English rhetoric, public and community. A. Revolutionary aesthetics, A minus. The sociology of gender, B plus. Islam and the West, A. And there at the very bottom, introduction to statistics, advanced. She felt like a marathoner staggering over the finish line. Introduction to statistics, C. She had passed, but with a completely undistinguished and forgettable grade. Neither a shame nor a triumph, neither a short story nor a novel. A novella. She'd written a novella. What a waste, she said to herself as she flicked her computer off. Might as well not have taken it. What she doesn't know now, of course, and what she will come to know in the fullness of time, is that it did matter, does matter, and it matters a lot. These things come up all the time in life. Over and over, we're faced with situations, sometimes of our own making, sometimes beyond our control. Disasters and frustrations, little and big. The clerk on the phone who won't do our bidding. The car that comes out of nowhere. The slow motion sound of crumpling metal. And when they come like that, loud and out of nowhere, it is always our choice how we react. Whether we choose to keep moving, head down, steadfast, and do what has to be done, one foot in front of the other, or whether we choose to disassemble. Soon enough, Stephanie will forget all the formulas she memorized. She's already forgotten most of them. And all the essays and all the seminars she sweated over, soon they will be gone too. But one thing won't. It is an hour later. It is noon. Her phone is ringing. It's Tommy. "I got your text," he said. I passed, said Stephanie. I knew you would, said Tommy. I'm proud of you. That was pretty good. Not that he could say it, but that she could. That night, her last night in that apartment, she had two things left in her pantry. I worked it down to the least common denominator, she told Tommy on the phone. A pack of Jell-O and a can of sardines. What flavor's the Jell-O, said Tommy. Berry blue, said Stephanie. Perfect, said Tommy. I'm coming over. When Tommy appeared, he pulled a Jell-O mold out of his backpack. Who knows where he finds these things? I'll make supper, he said. Stephanie said, fine, thanks, whatever. And she lugged a load of stuff off to the laundromat. When she came home, Tommy met her at the door. He led her into the kitchen and pointed proudly at a blue mound of Jell-O. He said, sardines in Jell-O. My favorite, she said. It's perfect, said Tommy as he picked it up. The sardines look like they're swimming in water. Especially when you jiggle it. Stephanie smiled, and she took him by the elbows and spun him around, and she looked right into his eyes, and she said, did I tell you I passed statistics? Tommy said, really? I knew you would. And then he reached into his backpack and pulled out a bottle. I asked the man at the store what would go well with this, he said. The man suggested aftershave. I chose this instead. He set the bottle of wine on the table, and he reached into his backpack again, and he pulled out a takeout box, and they sat down. The night was chilly, but not cold, not yet summer, but no longer spring. Tommy poured them each a glass of wine. He held his glass up between them. You made it, he said. You did it. Yes, said Stephanie. What are we toasting? You, said Tommy. She smiled, and she took a sip, and then she put her glass down. So, she said, what's next? Thank you very much. Well, sadly, we've come to the part of the show where it's time for us to say goodbye. Before we do, I want to thank you guys for being here today and for making it all possible. Also want to thank everyone who's been on stage with me. Dennis Pendroth on the bass, everybody. John Shear on the piano. Ruth Moody. Okay. So we got time for one more song before we go, and I got to tell you that this is my big musical moment. I chose this song. I chose this song because I love this song. And I went to Ruth. I said, you know this song? She said, I love that song. Wow, the two of us love the song. And I asked Dennis and John. They both said they knew it and liked it. And I thought, gee whiz, if everybody up here knows the song, maybe a good number of you know it too. And I thought, wouldn't it be fun? We came together in story Maybe we could say goodbye in song. I wanna fill this hall with music right now, so feel free to jump right in. You ready, Ruth?
I'm ready.
Dennis? John, okay, let's take her home. Let's do it. This week, Bill Herault, Lucas Simonetto, and Chris Jackson for the technical assistance. David Amers, the founding producer of the Vinyl Cafe. Greg DeClute is the recording engineer. Louise Curtis is the production assistant. Julie Penner is the music producer. Meg Masters is my long-suffering editor. Vinyl Cafe is produced by Jess Milton. And I'm Stuart McLean in Guelph, Ontario, and this is your last chance to sing. Here we go, John. Thanks for coming.
You've been listening to The Vinyl Cafe with Stuart McLean. Over the next few months, Stuart McLean will be doing live Vinyl Cafe concerts in Michigan, Indiana, Ohio, Ontario, Newfoundland and Labrador, and Saskatchewan, making stops in Clinton Township, Michigan, Bay City, Michigan, Indianapolis, Indiana, Cleveland, Ohio, Windsor, Ontario, Almont, Ontario, Milton, Ontario, Burlington, Ontario, St. John's, Newfoundland and Labrador, and Danceland in Manitou Beach, Saskatchewan. You can check the website for all the details, vinylcafe.com.
Thank you, everybody.
Looking for more CBC podcasts? Go to cbc.ca/podcasting.